Brian C. Wilson, author of the new book, John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age, is a professor of American religious history in the Department of Comparative Religion at Western Michigan University. He holds a Ph.D. in religious studies of the University of California, Santa Barbara. After writing an award-winning book on serial inventor and the leading Seventh-day Adventist of the time, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, the Fetzer Institute invited Wilson to write a full-length spiritual biography of the founder, John E. Fetzer. The Kalamazoo-based Fetzer was a radio pioneer, media mongrel, and longtime owner of the Detroit Tigers baseball team. But what most people didn't know was that John E. Fetzer was quietly behind the scenes and a significant figure in the consciousness movement and a spiritual seeker of the First Order. For more than 60 years, he sought ways to open the doors of higher consciousness, spiritual empowerment, paranormal insights, and energy medicine to humanity through spiritual study, science, and the influence of the wellness at his disposal. In John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age, Wilson not only explores the evolution of Fetzer's beliefs, but how he put them into action by permanently endowing three funds that will foster research into the scientific-spiritual interface for years to come and help cultivate a more peaceful, loving, and inclusive world founded on the principle that we are all connected through one infinite force. More information is available at www.infinitepotential.com. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Wilson, and I look forward to hearing about John Fetzer, spiritualist, and his quest for the New Age. Now, who was John Fetzer?
Well, John Fetzer was a very successful businessman in Michigan. He created one of the first commercial radio stations in Michigan back in the 1920s. And he basically parlayed that into a radio network and then later on got into television and cable and made millions off of that. And he's best known in Michigan today as the longtime owner of the Detroit Tigers. He bought the Tigers in 56 and sold them in 84. So that's how he's best known as a businessman here in Michigan and the Midwest. But what's most interesting for me, I'm a professor of comparative religion. So what really attracted me to Fetzer's story was the fact that parallel to his business interests, he was on a lifelong spiritual quest, and he basically studied a whole range of different metaphysical traditions, beginning with spiritualism, but branching off into theosophy and Hermeticism and Rosicrucianism. And he was a Freemason. And of course, he was very interested in the readings of Edgar Cayce and other psychics and channelers. And he basically used this to develop his own worldview. And then at the end of his life, he liquidated all his businesses and took the proceeds and endowed a foundation, which is now called the Fetzer Institute, to carry on this spiritual vision.
Great. Good. And what was he like as a person?
Well, unfortunately, I never actually had a chance to meet him. He passed away in 91, and I came out to Kalamazoo in 96. But talking to his friends and family and colleagues, they describe him as a very smart man, very astute, obviously a very good businessman. But he was also very private, too. And one of the things he was careful to do, especially in the early days, was to keep his spiritual search very private. And he had his friends who he shared his ideas with. But for the most part, even his closest colleagues didn't know all the kinds of things he was into. And part of that was due to the fact that Southwest Michigan tends to be pretty conservative religiously. And so he didn't want to, offend his audience or drive away his advertisers. So he became very careful about airing his spiritual beliefs. Mm-hmm. So he was very good at kind of compartmentalizing things. So he was a businessman on one hand, but he was also the spiritual seeker on the other. And it was only late in life, when he was in his 70s and 80s, that he began talking publicly about his spiritual beliefs.
I can see why he'd be hesitant, because I became interested in Edgar Cayce in the 60s, and people used to look at me like I wasn't quite right. And I was fortunate enough to go to the Cayce camp in the summer and volunteer as the nurse and get to know really all of the Cayce readings and all. And most of all, his spiritual work with the groups that developed the Search for God groups. And so that was a great experience. But I do understand why he was hesitant.
Yeah, it's very different today. We're much more accepting, and people are much more tolerant of alternative religious beliefs. Not entirely, of course, but far more than, say, back in the 1920s and 1930s. Yeah, things have changed quite a bit.
Right. And how did he get interested in metaphysical traditions and alternative spirituality?
Well, he was born and raised a Christian. He was baptized a Methodist. And when he was a teenager, his mother converted to Seventh-day Adventism. So he followed her into the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And that was a real opportunity for him, because he went to the Seventh-day Adventist College, which then was called Emmanuel Missionary College. And it's Andrews University today. And it's there that he basically set up his first radio station. But at the end of his 20s, 28, 29, he left the church. He broke with the church and basically started a much more kind of expansive spiritual search. And one of the first things he did is in 1934, he went down to a spiritualist camp in Indiana called Camp Chesterfield. And Camp Chesterfield is one of the oldest spiritualist camps in the country. There's now, and it's still operating, there's one in Florida, and there's one in upstate New York, Lilydale, and then there's Camp Chesterfield. And there he met a wide range of mediums and psychics and people who practice various divination techniques, and that just captured his imagination. They also had a bookstore. And it was a metaphysical bookstore, and he said that every time he went down there, and he continued going down there until the 1970s, he said he would always carry off an armload of books. So this is how he got interested in theosophy and hermeticism and kind of esoteric Freemasonry, and probably the first time he encountered the readings of Edgar Cayce, I imagine. So this became the starting point. And from there, basically until, you know, the day he died, he continued searching, continued seeking, continued reading, continued practicing. So it was really a kind of evolving spiritual quest that, you know, took him through the rest of his life.
I'm familiar with Lilydale, and also we have a metaphysical church here in Norfolk, Virginia, and I go usually once a month. They have a psychic fair, and I go mainly to support them because they are wonderful people. They're not into money at all, and that's what I love about them. But on the other hand, the chapel, the ceiling fell, and they've had trouble getting the money to repair that and other things. And
And there's always the problem with having an institution to keep up.
Right. But they're wonderful people because they are not into money, which is so common now.
Yes.
So what did Fetzer mean by spirituality?
Well, it's interesting because I think his spirituality really came out of his early experiments with radio. As a young man, his brother-in-law, Fred Ribble, who was a telegrapher for the railroad, got him interested in building a crystal set, so a very primitive radio set, way back when. And together, they were just fascinated that they could pull voices and music right out of the air. And the whole idea of these invisible radio waves kind of captured Fetzer's imagination. He began thinking, well, what's beyond that? What hooks up to that? I mean, these energies that we can measure are probably connected to energies that we can't. And so he began thinking about the reality of subtle energies. And so for him, eventually, he basically decided that the entire universe is composed of spirit, which he thought of in terms of the metaphor of energy, and that there was a great central sun, or sometimes he called it the father of radiation, but the great source of all spirit or all energy was radiating this out into the universe. And so for people who are attuned to it, since we're all energy ourselves, basically health and happiness could be had, and spiritual wisdom as well, if you tuned into the kind of great circulating energies of the universe. So for him, spirituality really was a kind of, how can we put it, an idea of the fundamental reality of energy, of spirit as energy.
And in what sense was he a New Ager?
Well, I think of him as kind of a proto-New Ager because he was talking about the New Age back in the 1960s, well before the term became popular in the 1980s. But what he meant by it was that he really believed that individual spiritual transformation was tremendously important, and that was always a goal to promote that. But for him, individual spiritual transformation would ultimately, hopefully, lead to global spiritual transformation. And basically the achievement of a higher evolutionary level of consciousness on the earth. So he always had this idea that his spirituality was not simply individualistic, but really embraced the globe itself. So that was what he thought of as the New Age. And of course, this is an idea he got out of earlier readings, for example, out of Theosophy, out of Alice Bailey and the Arcane School. But he put his own personal spin on it. And ultimately, he never left off that idea that there's got to be a fundamental connection between individual spiritual transformation and global spiritual transformation.
And what were some of his spiritual practices?
Well, early on, he was really interested in various forms of divination. So at Camp Chesterfield, he first encountered things like tarot cards and the Ouija board, and he used the Ouija board extensively throughout his life to make all sorts of decisions, business decisions, personal decisions. He also encountered the pendulum and using the mind basically to use the pendulum to help him make decisions. And then later in life, in the 1970s, he began to meditate. He felt that meditation was tremendously important for spiritual transformation. And the first meditation tradition he got into was transcendental meditation. And he became a good friend of the Maharishi Yogi and advised him on television and media and that kind of thing, and began practicing on a regular basis TM. And in fact, one of the famous stories is that he very rarely tried to impose his metaphysical ideas on his businesses. But in 1974, he offered training in transcendental meditation to the Detroit Tigers during spring training. And some of the players actually took to it and really enjoyed it and felt that it improved their game.
That's interesting because I interviewed someone that was in the Florida. I can't remember the team, but he was on National Football in the National Football League. And he meditated, and he said that helped him a lot with his playing.
Well, again, today it's not so outlandish. Back in the 70s, it was something new. And in fact, a funny story is that a minister in Michigan basically attributed the Detroit's losing season to the fact that they were practicing transcendental meditation. But today, nobody would blink an eye. It's become part of a big part of kind of sports medicine and kind of a holistic approach to sports medicine.
I remember back in the 70s, there were not many nurses with doctorates in the United States, and I was one of them. I think there were 200.
Wow.
And see, we didn't have doctorates in nursing, and so we all went Some people went to for a doctorate in physiology. I went for a doctorate in public health because my background was public health nursing. And so I got about 3-4 job offers every week, but I went to a place in Pennsylvania and I asked them, are there other people that you know of that meditate? And they looked at me like I had 3 heads. And I decided that was one of the deciding factors that I decided against going there because I figured I don't want to stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's tough being a pioneer. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did he see science and spirituality? Did he see them in conflict or compatible or what?
Oh, he felt that the idea that there was a conflict between science and spirituality was a great mistake. And again, I think this goes back to his radio days, where he really saw the technology of radio as shading into a kind of larger spiritual vision. And so he really felt that materialist science was tremendously powerful and important and a force for betterment in human lives. But he felt it was limited if it didn't have a spiritual focus. And so he really felt that the great spiritual transformation of the globe that he hoped for would only occur if science and spirituality were harmonized. And in fact, he looked for a kind of spiritualized science. And that was, in the early days, one of the premier foci of the Fetzer Institute. They funded a lot of research into basic science with a kind of spiritual focus, a spiritual perspective. So for Fetzer, science and spirituality were just simply two sides of the same coin.
Great, good. And what did Fetzer believe was the connection between mind, body, spirit, and health, wellness?
Well, John Fetzer, another tradition he was really interested in was New Thought and the whole idea of the power of mind over matter. So he was reading people like Ralph Waldo Trine and, of course, Norman Vincent Peale, and really taken with the idea that you can only have a healthy body if you have a healthy mind. And so thought is tremendously powerful over our health. And this was part of his larger spiritual vision, because if everything is spirit, everything is spirit energy, then it makes sense that when things are resonating in harmony, you would have health and wellness and well-being. And if things weren't, that was the root of both physical and psychological problems. And so during the 1980s, he actually was very interested in funding research into what we'd call today holistic health. And one of the projects he did was he funded the ARE clinic in Arizona.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
He worked with William and Gladys McGarry and Harvey Grady.
Right.
And he, in fact, what's interesting, he was interested in, for example, the castor oil packs and that research, but also he was fascinated with human energy fields. And he felt that if we understood the human aura better, we could come up with actual machines, actual technology that would help us to diagnose and treat disease. And he basically lived what he thought, because during the 1980s, he had a heart attack. This was the second heart attack. And so he did the traditional treatments, the traditional biomedicine, but he also checked himself into the ARE clinic in order to undergo a series of alternative health treatments. And he credits both the biomedicine and the alternative treatments for restoring his health. Yeah.
I think Bill McGarry died, but I think Gladys is still alive, if the last I heard.
I believe so, too. Yeah, I just heard that she's getting up there, but still spry.
Right. And, of course, Charles Thomas died in the last couple of years. We were friends for 35 years.
Oh, wow.
So it was a big loss to me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Right. And also, it sounds like Fetzer had a lot of the same interests that I do, because I developed an energy theory of nursing and health. I'm interested in all of the new age spiritual activities. I do go to psychics. I do many of the same things that he did. So I find him fascinating.
Oh, it sounds like you're two peas in a pod.
Yeah. And so why did he rely so heavily on spiritual advisors and channelers?
Well, he believed he, at some level, he had some psychic powers. He believed that his business intuition was actually a form of extrasensory perception.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, he really felt that he didn't have the kinds of experiences, that really signaled a connection with the transcendent that talented psychics and channelers have. So throughout his life, ever since the 1930s, when he went down to Camp Chesterfield, he relied on psychics and others to help guide his quest.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the 1960s, he was very good friends with Jean Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
And relied on her advice. And then in the 1980s, he came across a channeler and psychic named Jim Gordon. And Jim Gordon, who was living in Texas at the time, came up to Michigan periodically to lecture to a group called the Coptic Association of America, the Coptic Fellowship, rather. And he met John Fetzer, and they hit it off. And for the next, almost 10 years, I guess, Jim Gordon served kind of as his house psychic and channeler.
Mm-hmm.
And through Jim Gordon, who channeled the Great White Brotherhood and other ascended masters, he helped to basically define the mission, the early mission of what would become the Fetzer Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So John Fetzer really didn't feel that he had the kinds of experiences necessary to go it alone. And so he always relied on various channelers and psychics.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that all together, it worked for him.
Well, on the one hand, he was tremendously successful as a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, well, of course, part of it was just due to hard work and tenacity,
mm-hmm.
but and good business values. And part of it was due, he felt, on various kinds of psychic tools that he used.
Mm-hmm.
But probably the bottom line is, when he passed away in 1991, he really felt a sense of achievement that he'd actually done something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he died a happy man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the greatest kind of symbol of success that
right.
a person can have.
And how old was he again when he died?
He was just shy of his 90th birthday.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he lived from 1901 to 1991.
Great. Good. I'm hoping to make it to 90. I'm 86. My brother lived to 91. My sister will be 91 in November.
Wow.
So then I've got two brothers that have died and mm-hmm. a sister that has died. And then I've got two sisters left. So,
wow. Yeah, in my family, well, it's not my family, it's my wife's family. Her mm-hmm. grandmother is 108.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
so my wife comes from good genes. Yeah.
Is she healthy?
Not so much these days, not so much. But mentally, she's still very acute. She's
mm-hmm.
all there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great. Good.
Yeah.
Then how did Fetzer's belief in reincarnation and past lives impact the way he lived his life?
Well, he believed wholeheartedly in the idea of reincarnation and past lives.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point, he became interested in genealogy. He didn't know his father very well because his father died when he was just a child. And so he embarked on a genealogy project to chart his father's family. And then after that, he also did the genealogy of his mother's side of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's very interested in the connections between generations. And at a certain point, he became convinced that he also had gone through a series of past lives. And using psychics and also the Ouija board, he managed to reconstruct a kind of genealogy of his past lives,
mm-hmm.
going all the way back to Atlantis. And I think for him, the idea was that each one of these lives was a learning experience for him. And each
mm-hmm.
one of these lives, he had a mission, and he really felt that he was never successful in his past lives until his current life. And in his current life, he could actually marshal the wisdom that he'd gained through these past lives to accomplish the mission that he had set for himself. And mm-hmm. that was essentially global spiritual transformation. Mm-hmm. So for him, it was tremendously important. And he also believed in group reincarnation. He believed that his closest associates and friends had also shared past lives with him. And so they had this bond that went beyond just simply mere friendship, kind of transcended time and space.
I also believe in reincarnation. And the reason I believe in it is that I was sitting one day looking at a book of antiques mm-hmm. and I'm thinking, well, yeah, I've got that table and I'm thinking all this stuff. And then all of a sudden I realized it wasn't now. It was back in the 1800s.
Wow.
And I was a physician, a psychiatrist, and I traveled often to Europe. And then, you know, when I started thinking, it stopped. And so I never had any trouble with the concept of reincarnation.
Yes.
And also the meditation, I again agree with him that that is one of the most useful things in life, as well as the faith and the optimism and being positive and the things that it sounds like he was. You know, putting it all together, I think it makes for a good life.
Then, well, for John Fetzer, it definitely did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Then what was the spiritual meaning of wealth for him?
Well, as I said, he was very successful. He was a multimillionaire. And at a certain point, he was listed as one of the 400 wealthiest people in the United States by Forbes magazine. So he did quite well for himself. But he always lived a very, very frugal life. He didn't have the private jet or the chauffeured limousine or take, you know, mm-hmm. fancy mm-hmm. vacations and things like that. He lived in a very modest home here in Kalamazoo because he always felt that making money in and of itself was not the point.
Right,
and
right.
There always had to be a mission behind the money. And if you were just simply gathering up money, then spiritually that was not enriching.
Mm-hmm.
And he got these ideas by reading other, you know, metaphysical mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. books and tracts. And, mm-hmm. and there was a constant message, especially in a lot of theosophical books, that if people were blessed with great wealth, then, of course, they also had the great responsibility to use it for other people. So for Fetzer always talked about money is energy. Money is energy. It's energy to do things. And you can do, you know, good things or you can do bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, basically promoting spirituality and promoting this idea of global spiritual transformation was the mission, the reason, the ultimate reason behind the money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that that fits in so well with, I mentioned the metaphysical church, you know, where what I love about them is that they're not into money. They live very simply. And I found the same with Edgar Cayce from the readings.
Mm-hmm.
And his grandson and his son, they all lived very simply. So I think that that was probably a lot of what he was reading was that, you know, you can have fame or wealth or whatever, and you don't necessarily need to be showy like some people are today, but it's what you do with what you have that makes you happy, really.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it gives you points. I think that eventually you find God that way and
mm-hmm.
that then your life is directed and you have great joy in following what you are led to do and you become very passionate and then life becomes more than it is for many people, I believe.
Yes. Well, for a lot of people, wealth becomes a distraction, and it basically takes them away from whatever spiritual path they might be on. And I can imagine it's very difficult not to be distracted by it. So it's remarkable when people who are as successful as Fetzer manage to live a life like he did, or like Edgar Cayce.
Mm-hmm. Right. Definitely, because I have seen people that either had wealth or they strived for it
mm-hmm.
and got off the spiritual path.
Yes, and it becomes an obsession.
And it's sad.
Yes, you know, it is.
Because you can see the karma, for want of a better word, the karma that they are developing in their own life mm-hmm. which is going to make their life more and more difficult, I believe. Then did his spirituality help him become a business success?
Well, he believed it did. He believed, having a mission really motivated him and basically fed his ambition. So that, I think, was tremendously important. But he also, as I mentioned earlier, believed that his intuition, his mm-hmm. business intuition, mm-hmm. in making business decisions or in choosing the right people, had to do with a kind of almost a psychic connection. He talked about it in terms of extrasensory perception. Mm-hmm. And so he definitely believed that there was something extra there that was helping him be a business success. And he also used divinatory techniques as well. I mentioned earlier the pendulum, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. he always carried, it was just a very simple lead weight on the end of a string. And whenever he had a difficult decision to make that he was vacillating about, he would pull out the pendulum and basically ask it a series of yes-no questions. Mm-hmm. And based on that, it would help him make his decisions. And he also consulted, psychics and other diviners. But he was always careful. I mean, he never accepted things just completely uncritically. But he felt that this was, in most cases, a real boost, a real help in charting the best way of making his businesses a success.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever apply his spiritual ideas to his running of the Detroit Tigers?
Well, only on a few occasions. Again, he was very careful not to impose his beliefs on other people. He always said he believed in freedom of the spirit. People should have the right and the ability to follow their own spiritual path. But occasionally he did. And one, of course, is offering transcendental meditation classes for the mm-hmm. players during spring break. Another famous case had to do with a ball player, a pitcher named Mark the Bird Fidrich. Mm-hmm. And Fidrich was a very hot pitcher, but he had a very unorthodox pitching style. He would talk to the baseball on the mound, and he would have all sorts of rituals and kind of quirky things that he would do in order to pitch. And at a certain point, he got very self-conscious about this because I guess the sports writers were beginning to make fun of him. So John Fetzer brought him into his office one day and pulled out the pendulum. And in this case, it wasn't about making any kind of decision, but he wanted to convince Fidrich that you mm-hmm. could actually move matter using your mind. Mm-hmm. And so they sat there concentrating on the pendulum to see if they could make it move. And Fidrich, in his memoirs, said that yes, at a certain point he did. And the whole lesson there was that when Fidrich was off on the mound doing his kind of unorthodox things, he was essentially channeling his mental energy into his pitching. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. these were the rituals that were necessary to make him such a hot pitcher. And so apparently this helped him. And he got over his kind of self-consciousness and was never bothered again by, the kind of criticisms or jibes he got from the sports writers and others.
It was Damian Vaughn was the one I was trying to think of that I interviewed that was with the NFL who uh-huh. meditated. Do you know the name?
I don't, unfortunately.
He was with the Cincinnati Bengals, and what was the other one? And also with one in Florida, Orlando, I think, but I can't remember the name of the team.
Mm-hmm.
But he talked about it being so helpful to him.
Well, you can imagine that part of being a good athlete is, as they say, being in the zone mm-hmm. of, you mm-hmm. know, doing without necessarily thinking. And that's something that meditation must help with just tremendously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And why did Fetzer keep his spiritual search a secret until late in life?
Well, again, because he was concerned that, especially in the early days, that he would basically be misunderstood by his audiences and by his advertisers here in Southwest Michigan. Later in life, beginning in the 1970s, when he was considering selling off his businesses and really investing his energies into the Fetzer Institute, he began slowly but surely to become more public about his spiritual beliefs. But I think it's important that he had that period from the 1930s to the 1970s to basically develop his worldview really in private. because it gave him a great deal of freedom to experiment and to read and to think and to try out new things. And so I think by the time he was in his 70s, he was not only just mature, late in life, but he was also spiritually mature and could actually articulate what he was thinking in a way that was convincing to other people. So I think that keeping it private, at least for the early part of his life, was tremendously important for his development of his own particular worldview.
And you mentioned that he funded the ARE clinic in Arizona with the McGarrys. And were there other projects that he funded?
Yes. He in the 1950s, he got really fascinated with parapsychology. And so he was interested in the research, for example, J.B. Ryan was doing on clairvoyance and ESP. So the early projects of what was originally called the Fetzer Foundation, which eventually becomes the Fetzer Institute, the original projects were primarily in parapsychology. At a certain point, he got kind of frustrated with the parapsychological research because it wasn't advancing as fast as he'd hoped. And the other thing was that as he got into his 80s, in the 1980s, his physical health was beginning to fail. So his interest shifted towards funding alternative medicine and holistic health. And so he became very interested in his parapsychology days in biofeedback and funded that for years and years and years, and of course saw the greater kind of health benefits of practices like that. And then funded the ARE clinic, and he was also fascinated with energy medicine devices. So, for example, he funded the research of a Japanese parapsychologist named Hiroshi Motoyama. And Motoyama was really interested in coming up with machines that could measure qi, so the subtle energies that are talked about in acupuncture. And so he spent his life trying to come up with machines that would accurately measure the meridians in the human body, all of the I2 eventually using these for diagnosis and treatment. So those were things that John Fetzer was really fascinated with in the early days. When he passed away in 91, the Fetzer Institute went in a little bit more mainstream direction. And began funding holistic health research through the National Institute of Health and things like that. And they also got very interested in education. And they funded a really important series by Bill Moyers called Healing with the Mind. And this was in the early 1990s. And this series, which aired on PBS, was one of the first times that a lot of Americans had ever heard of alternative medicine. One of the first times they'd ever seen acupuncture basically talked about in ways that didn't make it seem strange or exotic. And so I really credit the Fetzer Institute during the 1990s with helping to further holistic health in this country and to basically educate the public about its possible benefits.
And do you know that Edgar Cayce was considered the grandfather of holistic health?
Yes. Yes, and that's why John Fetzer was so interested. He was there were two categories of Edgar Cayce readings that he was fascinated with, and one was Atlantis. He was just absolutely fascinated with that. But the other, and probably more important, was the holistic health and all the alternative healing remedies, both in terms of like the castor oil packs and treatments like that, but also the early energy medicine ideas that Edgar Cayce basically provided.
Do you think that his failing health had some effect on his moving away from the parapsychology to the holistic health areas?
Yes, I think so. Both he and his wife unfortunately suffered from heart disease and Alzheimer's in her late 80s. And so I think he had a kind of personal stake in this. But he also saw the parapsychological research was interesting, but the results were not really impacting a wider public. And I think he really felt like if he was going to invest in this kind of research, it would have to have a wider kind of a public impact. And holistic health and energy medicine, he felt, was one way of doing kind of basic research and basic research into a spiritualized science, but also would basically yield benefits, mm-hmm. especially technologies that he felt would be transformative in terms of medical practice.
He probably would be excited about what's going on now in the medical research, because there are physician researchers who are finding cures. I think of Dr. Dale Bredesen, who has found a cure for Alzheimer's, and then Dr. Carsten Eschelstein, who has been around for a long time, but also has alternative treatments for cardiology patients. And if they go on his diet, he says they will not have further heart issues. And
wow.
So there are, Dr. Walls has found a cure for multiple sclerosis. Dr. Longo has found a mimicking fasting diet that actually kills cancer cells in the lab.
Wow.
A diet. I mean, so there's some wonderful physicians, mostly physician scientists, that are bringing forth the treatments that would have helped his wife, among others.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they have the right approach. Instead of their trying to hold on to their treatment and treat all the patients, like Dr. Bredesen, for example, he teaches other doctors how to follow his protocol, so that it will reach more people. And he has a list of over 600 people, 600 physicians who have taken his courses and use his protocol, and they're all over the world. So it's an approach that it reaches many, many more people, and I think it's really exciting what's going on.
Yeah, I think if John Fetzer had lived to today, he'd be very excited with the kinds of breakthroughs that are occurring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think he'd be proud too, because he and the Fetzer Institute had a role in this, especially in the United States,
mm-hmm.
of educating the public to these things. And so it had, you know, a real, I think, significant kind of impact on the research that's being done today.
Mm-hmm. And how did he ensure his legacy would be carried on after his death?
Well, he basically, during the 1980s, sold off all his businesses, including the Detroit Tigers, and used that money to endow three different funds, three different foundations. The principal one is now the Fetzer Institute. And today, it continues doing funding projects that have to do with holistic health, but they've also branched out into other programs to promote spirituality across the life cycle. So they mm-hmm. have programs for spirituality for children and spirituality for seniors. And they also have a brand new program, which is about getting to the spiritual roots of democracy, and using spirituality as a way of getting people to talk about democracy in a way that hopefully will bridge the kinds of divides that are so prevalent in the country today. Another fund is the Fetzer Memorial Trust, mm-hmm. which John Fetzer set up to basically preserve his own legacy, and my book project is part of that. And they're also doing things like creating an online presence in order to digitize John Fetzer's writings mm-hmm. and speeches and papers mm-hmm. to make these available to a wider public. And then finally, the Memorial Trust also administers something called the Franklin Fetzer Fund, which funds very cutting-edge science, essentially holistic science, looking at the role of consciousness in physics and in biology. And this is pretty high-level stuff. It's very interesting and very intricate.
Mm-hmm.
But I think John Fetzer would have been very excited about the kinds of things that they're doing with the Franklin Fetzer Fund.
Mm-hmm. Great. And what attracted you to the Fetzer life story?
Well, I'm a professor of comparative religion, and I do I study new religious movements, and I'm especially interested in new religious movements in the Midwest. And my previous book was on another Michigander named Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, and that book was Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and the Religion of Biologic Living. And I became really interested in how individuals basically construct their spiritual worldviews. And so the Kellogg book came to the attention of the folks at the Fetzer Institute, and they invited me to come and look at John Fetzer and see if I'd like to do a spiritual biography. And once I started looking at the archives, which are extensive, of course, I jumped at the chance because it was another opportunity to basically chart the spiritual development of somebody in a very rich way, given all the documents and letters and books and things that have been collected. So for me, it was just a kind of dream project to be able to do this biography of John Fetzer.
Well, I'm glad you did, because I think it sounds like he's someone that should... people should be aware of and might not have been beyond the organizations that are receiving funds otherwise. So, and what are your own spiritual beliefs?
Well, I, as a professor of comparative religion, I jokingly tell people that my religion is comparative religion. I was nominally raised a Presbyterian, but have been fascinated by all sorts of different spiritual paths. So I kind of tell people that I'm a kind of an agnostic seeker. So on the one hand, I'm fascinated by all these spiritual traditions and paths and am just really interested in studying them. But also the scholar in me also wants to take a kind of critical approach to them. So for me, being a professor of comparative religion is the best of both possible worlds, because I can indulge kind of both sides of my personality, my seeker personality, but also my kind of critical historical personality.
It's interesting because there are different kinds of people with different beliefs teaching comparative religion, because I took a course at a university where I was on faculty, and a student raised his hand and said that he meditated, and the professor said, "Oh, you're a Hindu." And I was very offended by that, because, and I think the student was too. And I talked with the professor afterwards, and I said, "I also meditate, and that does not necessarily mean that we're Hindu." You know, I thought that was a very narrow approach to comparative religion. But
oh, I think so, too. I my goal in my classes is to get my students to understand other traditions and not to judge them right out of the gate. And so we kind of bracket out our the judgmental kind of faculty and really delve into the traditions in order to understand them as insiders would understand them. And that doesn't mean once you leave the classroom, you're not going to make certain judgments about this tradition is good or this tradition is bad. But in the classroom, the first goal is really to understand first. And I think the students appreciate this, because I don't take a judgmental approach to the teaching of religion or a normative approach and say this one's good or this one's bad. I simply want to expose my students to the wide variety out there. And then it's up to them to make the decision what they want to do. A lot of students come into my classroom and they have very firm religious beliefs. And, you know, it's not my goal to shake those beliefs, but the students basically come out of the class with a greater appreciation of their own tradition by looking at other traditions. And those people who come into the class who have no religious background or might even be anti-religious, I think have a better understanding of why people believe these things and practice these things. So that's my goal. My goal is understanding and tolerance.
Well, there still are those people around, because a friend of mine came to visit me about a month ago, and I thought that a student was driving him over and then spending the weekend with his parents, and my friend was going to spend the weekend here, but it turned out that they were just here for the day, and it also turned out that the student wanted to go with us because we were going to lunch, and then we were going to the metaphysical church, and I was getting a reading for my friend because he had just gotten over cancer, had never had a reading before, and the student wanted to go too. So we went, and the student was so excited. He couldn't, because I picked the psychic that was the best, and this one, he is just, he's fantastic. and the student couldn't get over that this person knew all about him and told him all of this stuff. And my friend told me afterwards that his parents, if they had known that he went, would have said, well, that's the work of the devil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there are still those people around. And do you experience any of this among faculty?
Well,
toward you, teaching?
Not so much, not so much. I think the big divide here at the university is that we have a lot of people, well, I won't say a lot of people, but there are some professors who are ideologically pretty anti-religious.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that's the divide there. So it's not simply they don't like metaphysical traditions or that, but they feel that religion is somehow retrograde and it's just at a university we should be teaching science. Now, I won't say there are a lot of those, but they're there. They're mm-hmm. there, and we're always kind of, interesting conversations about what C.P. Snow called the two cultures. Yeah, and mm-hmm. it's true of the humanities in general that there are faculty at the university who really think that university education should be technical and scientific, and mm-hmm. you're wasting your time mm-hmm. if you're doing the humanities. Mm-hmm. So we have our work cut out for us.
Right.
That's the major problem, major hurdle that we have to overcome.
Well, see, we have the same problem in health because there are those that think that all treatment should be drugs,
mm-hmm.
surgery, or for cancer at least, chemo, radiation, or surgery. That's the choices one has.
Yeah.
And so my role for years has been that there are other choices, and I don't care what people choose as long as they have all the information that allows them to make the choice that's best for them. And also, part of that includes the holistic approach, because I had lung cancer in 1974. I was given 6 months to live. I'm still here 44 years later.
Wow.
And prayer, meditation, affirmations, visualization, faith, optimism, all of these things were just as important as anything else I used. I did all natural. I did no chemo, no surgery, no radiation. And I think now people that interact with me see that this is important, that you don't have to have those three choices, but most of the people still choose one of the three. But
mm-hmm.
That's my goal, is to help many, many people. It's not just me. There are many people that are focusing on the holistic, and it's just great to see.
Well, if you can just get people to think about complementary approaches,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be necessarily either or, but in a lot of cases, you can combine treatments, and it's probably much more effective.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Wilson, if you will tell us about products, services, and your books, and how the listeners can locate these.
Sure. The book is available now on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and it's available in both a hardback and an e-book or Kindle version. It's published by Wayne State University Press. And if your listeners would like more information about the book and the Memorial Trust, they can go to a website, infinitepotential.com, and there they can find out more information about the Memorial Trust, and they can also download a free PDF of the preface and first chapter of Johnny Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. And if they're interested in learning more about the Fetzer Institute, you can go to www.fetzer.org.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wilson. This has been very, very interesting to me. I hope it will be to my listeners, and I hope to talk with you when you do another book.
I hope so, too. This has been really enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you. I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show. I hope some of the information was useful to you, and I look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks. I wish you the best for the next 2 weeks.